it's time for the Des Moines Register on Thursday, April 11. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, across the state today it will be windy, partly sunny, and cooler with a stray shower or two. Winds north-northwest, 20 to 30 miles per hour. Clear tonight, winds northwest, 12 to 25 miles per hour. The forecast through the weekend for central Iowa looks like this. Today and tonight, a high of 58 and a low of 41. Windy and cooler, a shower in places during the afternoon. Winds north-northwest, 20 to 30 miles per hour. Clear tonight. On Friday, a high of 65 and a low of 44. Breezy in the morning and sunny. On Saturday, partly sunny and warmer, a high of 79 and a low of 56. And on Sunday, very warm with a high of 86 and a low of 59. And tracking precipitation, in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Wednesday, we had zero precipitation. The month to date, we have had 48 hundredths of an inch against a normal of 1 6 hundredths of an inch. This time last year, we had had the year to date, we have had 5 19 hundredths of an inch against a normal of 5 71 hundredths of an inch. Last year, by this date, we'd had 5.7 inches of precipitation. Sunrise today was at 6:41 a.m., sunset tonight, 7:51 p.m., moonrise today, 8:12 a.m., and this says there's no moonset today. Turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, the lead article is entitled Imitation Game, Lawmakers Pass a Label Bill Targeting Meat and Egg Alternatives. Also, a bill signed allowing arrest of immigrants, and the Iowa House passes a bill regulating traffic enforcement cameras. Now, here with the first story is Linda.
Well, I'll read the story about the imitation products in the grocery stores. This is accompanied by pictures of egg substitutes and burger substitutes. Iowa lawmakers approved a bill Wednesday that requires specific labeling for lab-grown and plant-based meat and egg alternatives, sending it to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for her signature. The legislation requires meat and egg alternatives, including Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers, to include qualifying phrases like meatless or imitation if they're sold at Iowa stores. Dubbed the Meat Integrity Act, Republicans have touted it as a way to protect Iowa farmers' products from unfair competition and increase transparency for consumers. It is my utmost priority to advance this bill for Iowa's livestock producers, said Senator Don Driscoll, Republican of Williamsburg. Senate File 2391 passed the upper chamber for a second time on a 33-12 vote after it passed the House last week with changes. The bill previously passed the Senate unanimously. The dozen Senate Democrats who opposed the bill flipped their votes, citing House-led changes and language that could limit which meat and egg alternatives schools and universities are able to purchase for students. The original concept of the bill was a fine one, said Senator Herman Kornbach, Democrat of Ames. If we could have kept it a clean bill, I'd have been happy to see that go into law. I can't support this version. Under the bill, any of those products deemed to be mislabeled would be barred from purchase by school districts, community colleges, and Board of Regents universities. An investigation into mislabeling practices led by the Department of Inspections, Appeals, and Licensing would be triggered by a complaint made against a producer. Democrats in both chambers argued that it could lead to national brands being off-limits to Iowa buyers. Driscoll said many of those brands already have terms like that, and that the legislation aims to set a precedent here in Iowa. House Republicans amended the bill last week to include alternative egg products in the labeling requirements. Egg alternatives, often plant-based and an option for those with allergies, would also have to include a qualifying term, such as fake, imitation, egg-free, or plant-based. "I don't know what's in an egg-like product," said Representative Mike Sexton, Republican of Rockwell City. "Just leave the egg part out and say a breakfast alternative." Democrats took issue with language in the amendment that would have the state submit a federal waiver to bar sales of egg alternatives under federal nutrition programs such as SNAP. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confress, Democrat of Windsor Heights, said it was hastily tacked onto the bill and would hurt low-income families with dairy allergies. "It was a bill that was about labeling, and it became a bill about chipping away options for kids on SNAP," Confress told reporters last week. "It wasn't necessary." Frustration with the House changes was apparent on the Senate floor Wednesday, with Driscoll saying the chamber had, quote, "famously applied their special seasoning" to the bill. But she urged the chamber to support the legislation, despite some concerns that lingered. "I hope you will not let any concerns related to the egg provision hold up the meat of the bill for Iowa," she said.
Bill signed allowing arrest of immigrants. Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a Texas-style immigration law allowing Iowa officers to arrest undocumented immigrants under a new crime of illegal reentry. That's a quote from the bill, into the state. Reynolds signed Senate File 2340 Wednesday, making it a crime to attempt to enter Iowa after being previously deported or barred from entering the United States. It takes effect July 1. The Biden administration has failed to enforce our nation's immigration laws, putting the protection and safety of Iowans at risk, Reynolds said in a statement announcing the law signing. "Those who come into our country illegally have broken the law, yet Biden refuses to deport them. This bill gives Iowa law enforcement the power to do what he is unwilling to do, enforce immigration laws already on the books," Reynolds said. Biden has asked Congress to pass a bipartisan federal immigration law that would beef up border spending and give him more authority to combat illegal immigration. But Republicans rejected it after former President Donald Trump condemned it. Reynolds agreed, saying, "We don't need a new law." The Texas law that serves as the model for Iowa's legislation is blocked by the courts while a lawsuit challenging its constitutionality is decided. The U.S. Justice Department is suing over the Texas law, arguing it unconstitutionally usurps the federal government's authority to enforce immigration laws and could create chaos in administering the law. Reynolds has made multiple trips to the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years as she has criticized President Joe Biden's immigration policies. Iowa is currently deploying 10 Iowa Department of Public Safety officers and 110 Iowa National Guard soldiers to the border to support Texas's state law enforcement and military's immigration efforts. Immigrant rights groups have protested the Iowa legislation at the Capitol this year and vowed to fight it through legal actions, strikes, and rallies. Iowa Migrant Movement for Justice, that's an organization, said in a statement that, quote, welcoming immigrants and refugees is the definition of what Iowa Nice should be, end quote. The statement then goes on to say, Iowa politicians moved this ridiculous stunt forward in an election year in order to perpetuate partisan campaign rhetoric, drive fear in immigration communities, and mobilize voters using fear and anti-immigrant sentiment, according to the group. Immigrants' rights organizations are ready to fight back and work to block this unconstitutional law from going into effect. We know that we all belong here, Iowa is home, and we will stand together as workers, families, and allies to defend each other. That's the end of that long quote from the Iowa Migrant Movement for Justice. The law creates a new crime of illegal entry into the state, which applies to anyone who has previously been deported, removed, or denied admission to the United States. In most cases, the crime is an aggravated misdemeanor, which carries a 2-year sentence. But it rises to a Class D felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison in certain circumstances. And the crime becomes a Class C felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison if the person was arrested for another felony. For anyone convicted of illegal reentry, the judge in the case would have to enter an order requiring the convicted person to return to the country they had come from. The law forbids law enforcement officers from arresting someone if the person is in a school, a place of worship, a health care facility, or a facility for survivors of sexual assault. And the legislation provides legal immunity for local law enforcement and other government officials responsible for enforcing the measure.
The Iowa House passes bill regulating traffic enforcement cameras. Iowa House lawmakers have passed a bill placing regulations on automated traffic enforcement cameras in another attempt to resolve a long-standing debate in the Iowa Capitol. Lawmakers have struggled to pass traffic camera legislation for years, with some urging a complete ban, others pushing for regulations, and others seeking to preserve cities' control over the systems. While I certainly would prefer to ban these outright, the longer we sit around and do nothing on this, the more we're seeing these systems being abused across our state, said Representative Phil Thompson, Republican from Boone, who chairs the House Public Safety Committee. The House voted 85-12 to pass House File 2681, sending it to the Senate. A similar bill passed through a Senate committee earlier this year. Municipalities such as Des Moines and Cedar Rapids, which use traffic enforcement cameras, and law enforcement groups like the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, are registered undecided on the bill. But Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert told lawmakers March 20th during a subcommittee meeting on an earlier version of the bill that he appreciates lawmakers discussing a regulatory bill, calling it long overdue. All the things I see in this bill are on the regulation side are things we're already doing, things we've been doing since the inception, he said. The bill would require cities and counties seeking to use automated traffic enforcement cameras to first receive a permit from the Iowa Department of Transportation. To receive a permit, the local government would be required to submit a justification to the DOT for why traffic enforcement cameras are needed. The justification must include records of traffic violations at that location for at least 1 year, the number and severity of traffic collisions at the location, an analysis of traffic speed data, the cause of the safety issues at the location, and alternative methods that the local government has either considered or already implemented to improve safety. Traffic enforcement cameras could be used to issue tickets only when someone is driving more than 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. Communities with a population of 20,000 or less would not be allowed to use mobile traffic enforcement systems to issue tickets. Mobile systems could still be used to issue warnings for traffic violations. If the traffic enforcement cameras store pictures of license plates, the images must be deleted within 30 days unless they are part of an ongoing criminal investigation. Local governments must place signs from 500 to 1,000 feet in advance of any traffic enforcement cameras, notifying drivers that the cameras are in use. Every year by March 1st, local governments would need to submit a report to the DOT detailing the number of collisions and citations at any locations where traffic enforcement cameras are in use. People who are ticketed could provide evidence that they were not driving at the time the ticket was issued if they provide the name and address of the person who was driving the car. The bill also lays out a process regarding whether cities that currently use traffic cameras can continue to do so. Cities that already use traffic enforcement cameras prior to January 1st can continue them while they wait for the Department of Transportation to approve or deny their application for a permit to continue operating the system. They must submit that application by July 1st. Cities that began using traffic cameras on or after January 1st of this year will not be given a permit by the Department of Transportation until July 1st, 2026 at the earliest. Local governments could use money collected from traffic enforcement cameras only to fund transportation infrastructure improvement or to offset costs for operating their police and fire departments. An analysis of the bill by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency shows Cedar Rapids issued the most tickets and took in the most revenue in fiscal year 2023 of any city in Iowa that uses traffic cameras. Cedar Rapids issued 169,696 tickets and collected 94,037 fines. The city took in $7.2 million, which it designated to its general fund, and the company running the cameras took in $1.8 million. Des Moines issued 125,768 tickets in fiscal year 2023 and collected 84,991 fines. The city took in $3.6 million, which it spent on its public safety radio system, and the company running the cameras took in $1.9 million. The legislation would also standardize the fines that drivers could receive for speeding if they are ticketed using a traffic camera. The fines for speeding violations would be $75 for driving 11 to 20 miles per hour above the speed limit, $100 for driving 21 to 25 miles per hour above the speed limit, and $250 for driving 26 to 30 miles per hour above the speed limit. Lastly, $500 for driving more than 30 miles per hour above the speed limit. The bill doubles those fines for speeding in a work zone. House lawmakers spoke both for and against traffic cameras during Tuesday's debate. Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat of Cedar Rapids, who supported the bill, said his city has used traffic cameras to cut down on traffic accidents along Interstate 380 and elsewhere. Sheets said using cameras also reduces the number of traffic stops officers make along dangerous stretches of road. This technology not only saves lives by reducing high-speed accidents, but it also protects our first responders by minimizing risky traffic stops, Sheets said. Representative John Wills, Republican of Spirit Lake, offered an amendment to the bill that would have banned traffic enforcement cameras altogether. The amendment failed to pass, with 47 members in favor and 50 opposed. Willis said he believes traffic cameras violate the U.S. Constitution's Fifth Amendment due process provisions and Sixth Amendment right to be confronted by a person's accuser. He ultimately voted in favor of the bill. "These traffic cameras are speed traps," he said. "I don't believe they're constitutional."
And that concludes the front page stories of the Des Moines Register. We'll move now to the Metro and Iowa section. Slain correction officer's widow sues the state. On the day Robert McFarland was killed, there were supposed to be three corrections officers assigned to the Anamosa State Penitentiary Infirmary, according to his wife, Sarah Montague McFarland. In reality, he was one of only two officers stationed there on March 23, 2021. Sarah McFarland alleges this in a new lawsuit. Her complaint and prior state investigations and reports describe the prison as seriously understaffed. But even that overstates the level of security in the prison infirmary, according to the lawsuit, since at the time of his killing at the hands of two inmates attempting an escape, Robert McFarland's fellow officer was in a back room on a computer completing online training modules. Under Iowa Department of Corrections policy, she was required to do so at her post while on duty. That meant McFarland was the only guard present when prisoners Michael Deutscher and Thomas Woodward Jr. entered the infirmary posing as members of a work crew and carrying stolen tools for a planned escape attempt from the medium/maximum security prison. McFarland, 46, was fatally injured alongside prison nurse Lorena Schulte, both struck in the head with hammers before the two inmates unsuccessfully used an angle grinder to try to cut through bars over infirmary windows. Both men are now serving life sentences for murder. Tuesday, McFarland's widow sued more than two dozen Department of Correction leaders and officers for gross negligence leading up to his death, echoing an earlier lawsuit brought by Schulte's family. The complaint contains new allegations, including that the second officer was involved in training at the time of the attack, and paints a picture of widespread and systemic safety failures leading up to the killings. "The more information we got, the scarier and more infuriating it became," attorney Robert Rinkemper, representing the family, told the Des Moines Register. A Department of Corrections spokesperson declined to comment. Tuesday's filing is 130 pages long and names 27 individuals, from fellow guards to Department Director Beth Skinner, whose actions it says contributed to McFarland's death. "The most serious failure," Rinkemper, the attorney, said, appears to have been in managing access to tools. Among other shortcomings, the lawsuit alleges that the sergeant responsible for overseeing tools in the prison's maintenance shop often delegated to inmate workers the task of checking out tools to other prisoners. Many of those tools, such as the hammers used in the murders, were simply hung up on pegboards. Rinkemper says national prisons' best practices call for such tools to be stored off-site and kept under lock and key when within the prison walls. The prison also allegedly did not use a work order system or other means to track legitimate maintenance requests and did not require detainees to be checked by officers entering or leaving tool storage, problems known to prison officials at least as early as the 2019 safety audit that flagged tool control as a problem. On the day of the attack, the petition alleges, three of four employees' supervisors in the maintenance shop had left to show a new hire the lunchroom, and the last was in the office and out of view of the area, allowing inmates unsupervised access to the tool storage where Woodward and Dutcher found their hammers and grinder. They just walked in and helped themselves, Renkemper said. Inmate workers also were issued opaque black tool bags, making it easy to move tools throughout the prison unseen. The complaint notes, in a bleak twist, that prison policy at the same time required jail staff to use transparent lunch bags. Despite the 2021 attack and changes to policy and personnel since then, Anamosa still allegedly has problems securing its tools. The lawsuit claims that another hammer went missing earlier this year and has yet to be recovered. Like the Schulte family, the McFarlands allege that safety radios issued to jail staff often did not work. Tuesday's complaint explains in greater detail how that alleged hammer, how that allegedly hampered the response to the attack. After Schulte and McFarlane were attacked, the prisoners took hostage Lori Mathis, a dental aide who did not have a radio to call for help. A supervisor working on the floor directly above the infirmary heard breaking glass below, but also did not have a radio and had to go downstairs herself, where she observed bloodstains near the infirmary break room door. She then had to run back to find a phone to finally notify someone that an escape attempt was underway. The McFarlands also argue, again echoing previous investigations, that Woodward and Dutcher should never have been trusted with tools in the first place. Both had records of violence in and out of detention facilities, and Dutcher in particular had a long record, recounted in the complaint, of escape attempts and violent, threatening, and disruptive behavior toward jail and prison officers. Sarah and Robert McFarlane were married for 10 years and had a son together, as well as two children she had before they met. In an interview, she said they first met and became friends when they were working for a cell phone provider, and that McFarlane was very persistent in asking her to date him. "Actually, my grandma and younger sister both were like, 'You need to give him a try. He seems like a really great guy,' she said. 'We just started dating and he became my best friend, and it was on from there,' she added. McFarlane worked for a decade at Anamosa, and his wife said he sometimes told her about problems inside the heavy stone walls of the now 149-year-old prison. "He didn't want me to worry more than I already did, but stuff like the radios not working, that was something he told me a couple of years before this happened," she said. "You could see the worry in his face, but he wouldn't let on too much about it. It was what he loved to do, and that was part of the job, and he just did it," she said. Since his death, she's gotten involved in advocating for prison safety reform, including seeking to reverse a 2017 legal challenge that stripped the Correction Officers Union of the ability to negotiate over safety issues. While state officials paid a lot of good talk, she said, in the aftermath of the attack, 3 years later, the same issues are still lingering. State officials have for years sounded the alarm about staffing shortages in Iowa's overcrowded prison system. Renkemper said the root of their problem is their failure to follow basic safety policies in facilities such as Anamosa. "Locks are not that expensive. Following basic protocols and procedures is not that hard," he said. "You can't pay somebody enough, as we're finding out, to work in an unsafe environment," he added. Their goal of the lawsuit, Sarah McFarlane and Renkemper said, is to hold Department of Corrections leadership accountable for failing to make the investments and policy changes needed to ensure correction officers on the job are safe. "How much money is my husband's life worth? How much money was Lorena's life worth?" McFarland asked. It's going to happen again. What are they going to tell the next family? It needs to be taken care of, she said.
Blank Park Zoo is getting an $18 million makeover. Upgrades to include expansions of spaces for the big cats, the sea lions, and seals. When school lets out at the end of May and families flock to the Blank Park Zoo, they'll notice some major construction underway. The zoo will soon kick off the largest expansion and renovation in its history, an $18 million project that will improve accessibility, upgrade the big cat and seal and sea lion exhibits, and expand the zoo's sustainability. The zoo's first major project, the zoo has an opportunity to educate and inspire action throughout our state, starting in our own backyard, Blank Park Zoo CEO Ann Shermerdia said Monday, announcing the plans. Expansion to the physical property, programs, and conservation work will have a transformational and lasting impact for future generations. The lions will be moving to a space in the Jamaica Africa exhibit, triple the size of their current enclosure. The addition will include climbing structures, winter accommodations, and a breeding facility. The zoo's Holmes Foster Events Center, completed in 2021, will have prime views of the new habitat. The current lion space will be converted into a conservation center for the zoo's tigers. The remodeling, Shermerdia said, will help sustain the species, with the hope to one day breed the tigers in an effort to contribute to their dwindling population. With about 4,000 tigers left in the world, especially out in the wild, this will allow us to become leaders in tiger conservation programs, extending our actions not only here at home, but on a global scale, she said. The new lion space is slated to open in summer 2025. With work on the new tiger enclosure wrapping up by the end of 2026. The project also will include a brand new Wild Iowa exhibit sponsored by the Ruan Foundation. Though seals and sea lions aren't exactly Iowa creatures, it will feature a new facility for them that will be able to host behind-the-scenes tours. A new species, the bobcat, also will be moving in. Other Wild Iowa additions will include a new saltwater filtration system that will reduce the zoo's water consumption, a glass viewing tunnel and deep water viewing area for the otter exhibit, floor-to-ceiling windows to give guests an unhindered look at the enclosures, eagle exhibit space and a building with a mock-up of an Iowa river, a new aquarium featuring Iowa amphibians. The exhibit is expected to open in early 2026. Andrew Mollenbeck, a spokesperson for the zoo, said pathways will remain open during most of the construction. The zoo's goal is to have as few public viewing disruptions as possible, Mollenbeck said. When Wild Iowa is under construction, everything will remain open with few exceptions. The zoo has secured 2/3 of the funding needed to complete the expansion, equaling $12.3 million. Major sources of funding, in addition to the Ruan Foundation, include the City of Des Moines, the Nationwide Foundation, Iowa Economic Development Authority, and longtime zoo supporter Marjorie A. Foster. Shermerdia said the zoo expects to finish raising the remainder of the money it needs over the next few months. We're waiting on several grant applications that are already submitted, but of course,
There's always room for people to participate, she said.
Osceola floats a new plan to avert the drinking water crisis. Osceola is looking at pumping water from a nearby quarry to boost dwindling levels in drought-depleted West Lake, its primary source of drinking water. Osceola Water Superintendent Brandon Patterson said Tuesday the southern Iowa city of 5,600 could potentially tap 70 million gallons of water from the 9-acre, 50-foot-deep spring-fed quarry north of town. The proposal could help the city address an immediate water shortfall, providing it enough supply to meet 90 days of peak usage this summer, Patterson said. Despite recent rains, two-thirds of Clark County is gripped in severe drought, with the remainder experiencing moderate drought. West Lake is 7 feet below normal levels, and the city has ordered residents to reduce water use or face penalties. The Southern Iowa Rural Water Association says it will loan Osceola an industrial pump to move water from the quarry to the 320-acre lake. The Osceola Water Utility said it also would need what it called several thousand feet of hose to make the connection. After lots of discussions with regional water operators, local and state government organizations, testing and consulting with our engineers, we believe this plan is the best path for securing water for the community, Patterson said. While a temporary solution, pumping water from the quarry could begin benefiting Osceola within 60 days, Patterson said. Engineers already have completed a preliminary analysis of the quarry's raw water. Patterson said he's negotiating with the quarry owners. Osceola Water Works anticipates pumping water from the quarry late in the spring and potentially again in the fall, depending on how much the quarry can supply. Patterson told the Osceola Water Works Board he's working with state regulators to ensure no invasive plants or fish are introduced into West Lake. In addition to addressing the water emergency, Patterson outlined what he called an intermediate proposal that reduces water demand and, later, connects the Osceola and Southern Iowa Rural Water Association supplies. Osceola has been providing the Rural Water Association with about 350,000 gallons daily to serve parts of rural Clark County. But the Water Association anticipates less reliance on Osceola after recently completing construction of a $65.6 million water treatment and distribution system that taps Three Mile Lake in Union County. But even with the new treatment plant, the Rural Association anticipates needing about 200,000 gallons a day from Osceola to serve eastern Clark County during heavy summer demand because of infrastructure restrictions. Faced with that challenge, Patterson and Jeff Rice, the Rural Association's general manager, proposed evenly splitting $100,000 in cost to add a half mile of 8-inch main to serve eastern Clark County with water drawn from Three Mile Lake. The utilities also are weighing a $5 million plan that would connect the two water supplies, which would provide Osceola with short-term relief and later provide emergency supplies for both regions, according to Patterson. The project would take about 2 years to complete. At the same time, the city will continue pursuing its plan to use treated wastewater to recharge West Lake. Last fall, Osceola asked the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to approve the $16.5 million project, which is the first in the state seeking to recycle wastewater to supply drinking water. Long term, Osceola and surrounding communities want to build a nearly 800-acre reservoir that's estimated to cost $100 million. The project, which has encountered several roadblocks, could take 6 to 8 years. Patterson said he anticipates the city will pause a plan to move about 4 million gallons from two city water bodies, Grade Lake and Kew Pond, to West Lake, so Osceola can operate and open its aquatic center and water its municipal golf courses this summer.
Shooting at Des Moines Hotel leaves man dead. Des Moines police are investigating the city's second homicide case of 2024 after a 30-year-old Des Moines man was found dead and another person was left in critical condition in a shooting at a hotel early Wednesday morning. The Des Moines Police Department and the Des Moines Fire Department officials were dispatched to Ramada by Wyndham Des Moines Airport, which is at 1810 Army Post Road, for a shooting at around 4:30 a.m., police spokesperson Sergeant Paul Parisek said in a news release Wednesday. Officers found two Des Moines residents with gunshot injuries in the hotel, Parisek said. Police did not clarify if the victims were found shot in a room or the lobby. The unidentified 30-year-old died at the scene, and an unidentified 31-year-old was transported to a nearby hospital, Parisek said. The 31-year-old is listed under critical condition. The man who died will be identified after families are notified, Parisek said. This is the city's second homicide case of the year, both happening within the past 8 days. Police said more information will be released as soon as it becomes available.
Bar and mini golf for grown-ups is planned in downtown Des Moines. Spinning windmills and ripped artificial turf will soon be relics of the past as a new high-concept place to play mini golf comes to downtown Des Moines. Let's Go Putt is expanding its chain of indoor mini golf venues to Iowa with a location in the Wilkins Building at 713 Walnut Street, home of the Tea Room. Owner Michael Worley said it will be an adult-focused fat putter modeled after the Omaha, Nebraska four-course lounge he opened last year. Let's Go Putt also has a medieval putt location in the Omaha area and dinosaur-themed prehistoric putt in Lincoln, Nebraska and near Kansas City, Missouri. We have been looking to get into the Des Moines area for a few years, Worley said. It seems like a very healthy and active downtown, and we're hoping to recreate the success we've had at the first location. The 11,600-square-foot space will house 3 9-hole golf courses, a full bar, and a golf simulator. Worley said the location will be pretty similar to the Omaha Fat Putter, which features a different theme for each hole. It's open to all ages during the day, but it's limited to the 21 and up crowd from 6 p.m. to close. The Des Moines Fat Putter is slated to open this fall. The Wilkins Building is the western portion of the former Yonkers department store, salvaged after a massive inferno destroyed the rest of the now-defunct chain's long-closed downtown store in 2014. It was later converted into 60 apartments with commercial space on the first floor. The department store's historic tea room, located on the sixth floor, also was restored and reopened as an event venue. The Wilkins Building's first floor now opens into Walnut Street, which finally reopened a year ago after having been closed since the fire. The Fat Putter will lease the entire floor. Fat Putter isn't the first venue in the metro to put a spin on mini golf. Putts and Pins opened in November near West Des Moines' Jordan Creek Town Center with what is described as high-tech, gamified mini golf. Owner Mitchell Kahn told the Register all the holes are interactive, with some requiring players to take a trivia quiz before they can move on. Kahn said he hoped Putts and Pins would be the first of a chain he and his brother start in Midwest cities. Bombers Golf, under construction in Johnston, will offer an indoor mini golf course snaking through an arcade and an outside putt-putt golf course similar to those at Tiger Woods' upscale Pop Stroke restaurants, which resemble miniature versions of traditional golf holes.
That completes the metro section. Going back to the main section, trial begins for man accused of killing Des Moines architect in 2016. Family and friends of Kirk Blunk, a prominent Des Moines architect
who died after being found severely injured at the bottom of a staircase in 2016, filled one side of a Polk County courtroom Tuesday to hear opening statements in the trial of the man accused of killing him. Zachary Allen Gaskell, 33, was arrested and charged with second-degree murder in the death of Blunk in December 2022, nearly 7 years later. Blunk specialized in renovating historic buildings and helped pioneer efforts to revitalize the East Village and Sherman Hill. Prosecutor Monty Platts said in his opening statement that Gaskell caused Blunk to fall down the stairs of the teach-out building at 500 East Locust Street, which he renovated and where he had an office, which caused the injuries that killed him. Gaskell's attorney, Mike Adams, meanwhile asserts Blunk may have been drunk during the encounter, claiming he drank at least 4 glasses of whiskey prior to the incident. Shortly before Blunk died, Gaskell allegedly attempted to enter a locked room on the 6th floor of the building to which he did not have access, Platt said in opening statements. He allegedly made contact with Blunk at 4:11 p.m., shortly before the victim texted his wife 911. Blunk died from what the Polk County Medical Examiner ruled to be blunt force trauma due to a fall from a height. He was found by a Bernie Sanders campaign worker who was in the building when the incident happened, Platt said. The witness had heard a scream and went downstairs to find Blunk. The worker told police that Gaskell passed them in the hallway and claimed Blunk assaulted him, gave a false name, and fled the scene with a woman tugging at his arm. Adams said Gaskell admits that he gave a false name to the witness because he was on probation and didn't want to get in trouble with police for drinking. Gaskell originally told police he entered the 6th floor of the teach-out building to use the restroom after he could not find one in the up-down bar, which is in the basement. He claimed he ran into Blunk behind a locked door on the 6th floor, which led to a verbal exchange in which Blunk accused Gaskell of trying to break into the room. Platts alleges Gaskell told different accounts of the story, one being that Blunk charged him with a knife, causing Gaskell to throw him over the railing of the stairs. He asserted that family and friends said Blunk was a peaceful man who never sought out a fight or an argument with anyone. During his opening statements, Platts also showed transcripts of a phone call between Gaskell and his mother while he was in jail. I won't lie, it was pretty intimidating being in a room with the family when you killed their dad, Gaskell said in the transcript shown to the jury on a video screen. It sucked being there, like I killed your dad. You guys want to kill me. I totally understand. Jury selection started Monday. The trial is expected to last 5 to 7 days.
Iowa Senate passes a bill to help Boy Scouts sex abuse survivors. Iowa Boy Scouts who were sexually abused as children will be able to recover more money through a national bankruptcy settlement under a bill passed Tuesday by the Iowa Senate. The Senate voted 46-0 Tuesday to pass Senate File 2431, sending it to the House for consideration. Although it's not going to be able to take away the true pain that happened years ago, hopefully this will give a little bit of relief to their lives going forward, said Senator Ted Kruenbrink for Dodge Republican, the bill's floor manager. Hundreds of Iowans are part of a national 2020 bankruptcy settlement agreement with the Boy Scouts of America, which designates a $2.46 billion fund to settle decades of sexual abuse cases from over 82,000 victims who were abused by Boy Scout troop leaders. But because of Iowa's strict statute of limitations, former Boy Scouts from Iowa are at risk of losing out on millions of dollars unless the state changes its law. The legislation removes the statute of limitations for claims related to child sexual abuse only for people who are part of the 2020 bankruptcy settlement. Without the law change, Iowans would be at a disadvantage because the settlement uses a matrix of factors to determine how much victims can be paid. They include how much abuse the victim suffered, how long it lasted, and the state's statute of limitations on sexual abuse claims. Iowa's statute of limitations on civil claims requires child sexual abuse victims to file suit by the time they turn 19, or if the abuse is discovered after the victim becomes an adult, the claim must be filed within 4 years of when they make the connection between their abuse and their injuries. Senator Janet Peterson, a Democrat of Des Moines, said the bill will prevent Iowa abuse survivors from being financially penalized simply because their abuse occurred in Iowa. I also want to thank all of the Iowans who I know are listening, I'm hearing them on my phone, who shared their stories with lawmakers, painful stories, requesting our help to prevent a system that failed to protect them as children from harming them again as grown-ups, Peterson said. The bill passed Tuesday by the Senate only applies to people who are paid who are part of the Boy Scouts of America settlement. It does not change the current civil statute of limitations law for other survivors of child sexual abuse. In 2021, Iowa lawmakers removed the statute of limitation for filing criminal charges in child sexual abuse cases, but left in place the strict limit on civil lawsuits.
Iowa farmland owners can dig into soil health with ISU Workshop Series. Iowa landowners interested in learning more about soil health and conservation have a chance to dig in through a new Iowa State University Extension program. ISU Extension plans to connect landowners with conservation, agronomy, finance, and legal experts to learn more about ways to improve their farms. The program is targeting landowners in the Des Moines River watershed, a water source for about 600,000 residents in the Des Moines metro area. This is the first year for the program, which asks participants to commit to attending 6 in-person educational workshops from June to August. Conservation workshops will focus on practices like planting cover crops, reducing tillage, and using perennials, as well as obtaining financial incentives for conservation practices. A legal workshop will include discussions on lease structures, taxes, and sharing expenses. A communication workshop will cover strategies for talking about conservation practices with family members, tenants, and others important to the farming operation. The program acknowledges that there are many steps in implementing conservation practices, ISU says. We know landowners care about their land and value stewardship, but may need help navigating the financial, legal, and relational aspects of transitioning to conservation land management. The workshops, lasting between 2 to 3 hours, will take place in central or north central Iowa. The deadline to apply is April 19th. Interested landowners may apply by taking a short survey available at the ISU Extension website at natural
resources.extension.iowastate.edu/programs/landowner education to assess if the program is a good fit. Those with questions about the program should contact ISU's Catherine DeLong, or she has a website, or I mean email, crdelong@iowastate.edu, or another person, Julia Baker@iowastate.edu.
Chemical plants must limit emissions. More than 200 chemical plants nationwide will be required to reduce toxic emissions linked to cancer under a rule issued by the Environmental Protection Agency on Tuesday. The new regulation advances the Biden administration's commitment to protecting vulnerable communities burdened by toxic air pollution from petrochemical plants. The new standards are also part of President Joe Biden's initiative to lower cancer rates in the United States. According to the EPA assessments, about 104,000 people in the U.S. live within about 6 miles of facilities that make synthetic organic chemicals and various polymers and resins, including neoprene, and those living near these facilities face elevated cancer risk. Previous assessments from the EPA and public health experts have also noted that people living near polluting industrial facilities are proportionately poor and more likely to be black. These residents have borne the brunt of toxic air for far too long, EPA Administrator Michael Regan said in a statement. We promise to listen to folks that are suffering from the pollution and act to protect them, Regan said. Today, we deliver on that promise with strong final standards to slash pollution, reduce cancer risk, and ensure cleaner air for nearby communities. The new rule primarily targets industry plants that emit ethylene oxide and chloroprene, according to the EPA. Ethylene oxide is used as a sterilizing agent for medical equipment, and chloroprene is used to make synthetic rubber. The two chemicals are mostly produced by facilities in Texas and Louisiana, where minority communities have elevated rates of cancer and other critical health issues. According to the EPA, long-term exposure to these two chemicals can increase the risk of certain types of cancer, such as lymphoma, leukemia, breast cancer, and liver cancer. Under the new rule, cancer risk for people living in these communities will be reduced by 96%, the EPA said, and more than 6,200 tons of toxic pollutants will be cut each year. Once implemented and combined with other EPA rules issued last month restricting ethylene oxide emissions from commercial sterilization facilities, the new rule will reduce ethylene oxide and chloroprene emissions by nearly 80%, according to the agency. Patrice Sims, vice president of environmental law firm Earth Justice, called the new rule a victory for our pursuit of environmental justice. The rule also requires fence line monitoring for covered processes and equipment that make, use, store, or emit pollutants. Fence line monitoring will help chemical manufacturers identify possible leaks from their facilities, which they will have to fix if annual average air concentrations are higher than the threshold, according to EPA. Chemical plants will also be required to reduce emissions of other dangerous chemicals, such as benzene 1,3-butadiene, ethylene dichloride, and vinyl chloride. By cutting emissions of these chemicals, the rule will reduce the risk of developing cancer for breathing in toxic air pollutants, the EPA said. In addition, the rule will reduce smog-forming volatile organic compounds by 23,700 tons a year. Well, it's time for us to go to birthdays in just a moment, so we will finish this article after we hear our birthdays and we hear today's obituaries.